From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part 5 in its series of discussions about American secondary education, with attention to issues such as the role in education of special interest groups, the legislative process and its impact on the schools, the increasing number of court cases which affect education, the question of students' rights, and the legitimate role of authority in the schools. The speakers are Dennis Doyle, Donald Steadman, Carl Dulcy, and Gilbert Sewell. Dennis Doyle is Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Donald Steadman is Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of North Carolina. Carl Dulcy is Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Gilbert Sewell was Education Editor at Newsweek magazine. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's completing a book on curriculum reform in American secondary education. The discussion begins with Dennis Doyle's comments on some of the special problems facing school districts with large populations of minority students.
And my sense, for what it's worth, is that the principal problem the schools have gotten themselves into in dealing with that particular population is to treat them with almost complete condescension. Implicit in the style of organization, the pedagogy, the curriculum, the rest of the activities in the school, is the notion that these kids can't learn. And I think that does irreparable damage to the children. I think it's probably harmful to teachers to hold such attitudes. And I think it is completely wrong and ill-founded.
Well, where did that attitude come from?
I think because of the interaction effects of race and class. It is, in fact, true that children from lower social classes experience much greater difficulty in learning conventionally than their more well-advantaged middle-class and upper-middle-class fellows. So it does, in fact, take some special training, some special treatment, probably some special resources. But that is not the same, of course, as saying that the victim is to be blamed for his own victimization.
Well, that's right. And Dennis, too, so much of it, that concept came out of the testing movement. Mm-hmm. Back in the mid-70s, I was involved as an educational witness on behalf of the involved in the Pennsylvania Association for Retarded Children against the Commonwealth on a right to education class action suit, and my job was to account for the disproportionately large number of black minority children in educable mentally retarded classes in Philadelphia. And a lot of it was simply the inability on the part of individual test givers or group test givers to appropriately administer a testing procedure to children with language limitations or vocabulary limitations or inadequate selection of tests and so forth. And that helped feed, you know, if it was by and large pretty obvious that the majority of self-contained classrooms in the public schools for educable mentally retarded were populated by lower socioeconomic class black children, then you suddenly began to equate inability to learn with that fact. And then it's only been in the last 3 or 4 years that we've really recovered from that.
One can assert with complete confidence that there has never been a coherent federal government policy toward elementary and secondary education from the perspective of educational issues. There have been coherent federal policies as regards civil rights and income redistribution and income transfer programs and so on. And in fact, it seems to me the way one successfully analyzes the Great Society is principally as a civil rights and income redistribution program, one which used the schools as a vehicle to accomplish some of these objectives, but a set of programs which were virtually content-free in educational terms. Now we're treated to the spectacle of people trying to justify Title I on the basis of academic outcomes. Well, that's ironical in the extreme, because Title I was never intended in any literal sense to be measured that way. The success of Title I is the extent to which you deliver the goods to 90% of the nation's congressional districts and essentially a secondary income transfer program so that poor children from poor families have some extra resources available to be used on their behalf. And if there are some educational outcomes in addition to that, so much the better. But it was never conceived of as a true pedagogical effort. And I think that's true in terms of all the other preferential treatment for different groups.
Well, I think that one of the good models is the handicap movement. You know, Public Law 94-142 is a perfect example of the end product of a long period of pushing on the part of a subset of parents and professionals in this country that wound up, like a lot of things do, kind of overstating the case, going beyond research data, and expecting an administrative strategy to solve the problem, and along the way spawning a kind of a legal orthodoxy and a whole population of legal beavers who are now more inclined to sue than to investigate what the situation really was. I mean, we've really got that's fed into the, and it's been fueled additionally by the civil rights movement. You know, a lot of the legal tools that were used by the handicapped were observed from afar. You know, they saw Brown versus Board of Education, class action suits as a tool, personal litigation. There's hardly a state in the country whose governor and State Board of Education hasn't been sued on behalf of the of education of all the handicapped. And
it is explicitly and deliberately a civil rights strategy and program, one which they incorporate into law. Section 503 Rehab Act is about a paragraph long, and it establishes the civil rights of the handicapped. And then PL 94-142 built on that very successfully and skillfully. It is probably the greatest single political triumph in education of the past decade, an extraordinarily interesting and skillful execution by a dedicated, motivated, and very intelligent, vertically integrated lobby, which knew just what it wanted and how to go about getting it. And it, in addition to delivering the goods for special education, it signaled two other things. One, the very seriously flawed nature of federal education programs, which deliver monies to categories of children, which just reinforces the interest group politics. And two, the collapse in the 70s of the old horizontally integrated education lobby of PTA and NEA and administrators and so on and so forth, and the gradual replacement of this horizontally integrated group, or what the Europeans would call a united front, with a set of highly motivated, vertically integrated lobbying groups, each one of whom discovered that by judicious application of leverage, it could secure what it thought was important for its own constituency.
We've all been lectured on Jeffersonian democracy, but then you look at what it is you have to do in order to get something done for your group, and you cut a different route. It's also affected very substantially by the economic times. You know, we have swung very quickly from a personal rights climate to a common good climate. I mean, decisions are, you know, and all of it comes with it, that you can say, well, you know, we've got limited resources, we have to put them where they'll do the most good, and that's fairly compelling. Court decisions are made based on economic impact now, you know, always have been, but it's more overt, I think, at least from where I sit. And so the strategies have to change, and the advocates for handicapped are worried now that 94-142 will be dismantled, or at least the least restrictive alternative contact, you know, that aspect of it, which was the essence of it when it began. And you just can't discount the real or the apparent economic climate when you think about it in more esoteric terms or more philosophical terms.
I think some things occurred which the founding fathers didn't envision, which have created problems for the political system. For example, the rise of single-issue groups is a kind of thing that was not really thought of in colonial days, but when you got a group that has one issue and only one issue, and you, irrespective of other areas of agreement, there might be 99 areas of agreement, but there's one area of disagreement, therefore I'm against you or you're against me, has created some problems for the system. And one sees this particularly in areas of high emotional charge like 94-142, where a congressman might have voted, quote, right in all instances, but now the crucial vote comes, and if that congressman didn't support 94-142, then as far as those constituents are concerned, that's out. The other thing that I think we're seeing with some legislation such as this is that the political process is working. It's not broken down completely. The concern of the advocates of 94-142 is a real concern. They should be concerned from their point of view as to whether or not that legislation will remain on the books, because counter-political action is taking place as a corrective mode, and it's quite possible that some of the excesses of 94-142, particularly the costlier aspects, will be removed from the legislation. So I see some fundamental changes as having taken place. On the other hand, I don't regard them all as bad. The view, even though it does place additional burdens on school people, the view that children and students are entitled to procedural due process, I happen to think is the correct view. I think that the notion that school people can arbitrarily do anything to anybody under any circumstances is fundamentally wrong. The problem is that very often school people don't have enough guts to do what they are legally able to do, and there are no legal impediments to the action if they do the thing right.
I'm less sanguine about student rights than you. First, I believe that the contractualization of relations between adults and children is a dangerous thing, particularly when so many advocates of a legal relationship hold the older concept of in loco parentis in such contempt. I think often the presence of due process protections chills authority, makes many educators appear spineless, often leads to a situation in which the school climate, instead of becoming more just, becomes more tense, litigious, and adversarial. One can argue that the formalization of relations between adults in schools and children in schools has contributed to intergenerational conflict.
Well, I would use a substitute term for your chilling relation, administrative actions, or whatever the subsequent wordage was. I would say that it tempers administrative actions, and I happen to think that all administrative actions should be tempered by something. The day when the school principal said to a student, get out and stay out, with no reason, I think is gone, and I'm glad it's gone, very frankly. I think that the burden rests with the administration and the bureaucracy to demonstrate that at least some modicum of due process has been given to students. Contractually, you know, you talk about contractual relationships. That might or might not exist. It depends on the student, the family, and the reaction of the school. School people have a lot more authority than they're willing to exercise very frequently. They just don't take the bull by the horns and indicate that certain kinds of actions are clearly unacceptable, and they have the legal right to enforce some sanctions.
But when they do, they're often burned. Take the recent case at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, in which students were wearing buttons saying, "Nuke BCC. The administration thought this was inappropriate, I think with reason. The students countered by going to the ACLU and threatening legal action. The school caved in instantly. What kind of training is that?
Well, the appropriate comment there is that school officials were asleep at the switch, and they should have known in the first place that that would not be upheld in the courts. So when they transcend what is clear legal document, it seems to me that they're setting the bad example. In other words, there are limitations to power, and it seems to me that those limitations are applicable to a school system or school administrators. And what's the catastrophe with the buttons? Let me ask the question in that way. In other words, are the walls of the school going to fall down? Now, it's clear in terms of the courts that if the wearing of the buttons had led to disruptive behavior, all right, that is subject to school discipline. But the very wearing of the buttons, what's the problem?
In my mind, it does not add to the abiding of the school. If we extend that and consider youngsters in high schools wearing T-shirts proclaiming their advocacy of drugs or of free sex, one can worry about the tone they set for other students.
Now you really jump from one set of expressions to another.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to Part 5 in a series of discussions sponsored by the National Humanities Center on American Secondary Education. The speakers are Dennis Doyle, Carl Dulcy, Gilbert Sewell, and Joseph Adelson. Dennis Doyle is Director of Education Policies Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Carl Dulcy is Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Gilbert Sewell is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's finishing a book on educational reform. He was education editor at Newsweek magazine. Joseph Adelson is director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Michigan. Here is Dennis Doyle.
The nearest analog we can think of to public schools is probably penal servitude, in the fact that it is involuntary servitude. Given a situation of compulsory attendance in many jurisdictions to age 18, given the fact that there are really no other alternatives for many kids, they can't afford private alternatives, I think the provisions of due process are absolutely essential to the well-being of the student and the student's family. I think that arbitrary and capricious power exercised by schools is dangerous, and I'm enough of a libertarian to believe that students have to be protected from some of that. However, I think Gill's point is absolutely right in terms of maintaining the ethos of a school, and one of the important elements of that is the capacity of the school to expect of its students that it behave in a certain way in terms of dress, behavior, speech, not to mention curriculum and other activities. And the only way I can think to finesse this is to propose what would essentially be a privatization of schooling, so that you can get much more careful and successful matching between students and schools, so that schools that do feel strongly about dress and behavior and other codes, including don't nuke the school buttons, would be in a position to deliver on that and expect that their students would not do that. You wouldn't get into these kind of arbitrary value clashes in the school setting.
But Dennis, doesn't that simply isolate, pardon the expression, the good guys from the bad guys? It doesn't solve the problem. It just puts the kids who are going to behave in one fashion in one school and the kids who are going to behave in another fashion in another school.
Well, that takes me full circle to my point earlier this morning, and that is, that's true if you assume that the opposite of a good school is a bad school.
But you have other options.
On a linear continuum in which the distribution curve is such that you have 10% of your school's bad, 10% excellent, and the rest somewhere in between. I would propose that for the vast majority of students, there is a school setting which can be designed, which will be effective and successful, which will meet their needs and meet the interests and capacities of the faculty. And I think that's achieved through a very substantial diversification of school offerings. I think the one best system really puts us in a ferocious bind when all the schools essentially look alike, act alike, and act and look alike for the oddest of all reasons, not because we have a standardized system of education run by a minister of education, but because the American culture of schooling through its 16,000 school districts has just fallen out that way, so they all look exactly alike.
I would like to, though, qualify my stand in one sense, that I do think that the courts have gone to excesses in a number of instances, which I think are unreasonable and go way beyond due process kind of thing that I'm concerned about. Specifically, I'm thinking about the judgment of certain courts that children in special ed can't be suspended or expelled by virtue of definition. In other words, they are, let's say, mentally retarded. Therefore, no matter what those students do, they can't be suspended or expelled like other students. Now, I clearly think that that kind of a judgment is erroneous and will lead to some very bad consequences. And that's special, that's, again, the kind of a special decision for a special population. And that, I think, tends to be dysfunctional.
Does every young person have the right to attend and be accommodated by the public school system?
As a statement of legal fact, and it depends on the course of the jurisdiction, if you mean in a kind of a cosmic sense, should that right be enjoyed by people?
As I understand it, mm-hmm. Today that right is enjoyed.
It varies greatly across the country. New Mexico is one of the few states with a compulsory attendance age of only 14. Mississippi has no compulsory attendance statute left in the books. California has an effective compulsory attendance statute of 18. Puerto Rico has one of 16. Although it's honored in the breach, kids don't go to school in Puerto Rico. They do not obey the compulsory attendance laws. Large numbers of them do not. I don't think that there is such a thing imaginable as a right without reciprocal obligations. So that one could argue that, yes, students have a right to an education to a certain age, so long as they are willing to play by the rules of the game. And I guess I would have to cast the formulation. That the schools can expect certain minimums of civility and behavior and attendance and observance of rules and procedures. And failure to do so essentially invalidates the right, a kind of a social contract or social compact in schooling analog.
But increasingly, the schools don't have the right to set the rules. I mean, the rules are being set by other people, and they're often being set in a very crude and heavy-handed way by people who know nothing about the issues. I think this is what troubles everyone. You know, in terms of what Carl was saying, you know, all of us either have seen or heard of or experienced those horror stories of, you know, the old line, you know, teacher, principal, what have you, who did, you know, just awful things without fear of reprisal or without recourse on the part of the student to reply and so on and so forth. I think that's a thing of the past, but one can, of course, see it returning without these controls. But the problem is it's an instance where the cure of that has been disastrous. This is why I also agree with both Carl and Gil on this issue, because you know it's hard not to. I mean, if you take a look there, I mean, you know, with the example I was giving in one of our breaks of the these kids at the Ann Arbor High School, one of the Ann Arbor High Schools, who committed a fairly serious act of vandalism. Their punishment was to be not allowed to attend the graduation, which I would think would be a blessing rather than a punishment. But nevertheless, they took it to court, and they got a judge to say they're right. And that puts, you know, the effect of that, the long-range effect of that, is to weaken the hand of authority. I mean, now that was not, as I said this before, wasn't as that he was doing anything, disastrous to those kids. It wasn't spur of the moment. It was a considered punishment. It wasn't a drastic one. And nevertheless, it sets a precedent wherein if you have a grievance, and in any school with thousands of kids, you're going to have lots of grievances. You know, and if you have the litigiousness for it, and the paranoia for it, and the money for it, you'll get a lawyer, go to the judge, and get back. And this is what we have increasingly. Then we had another instance involved teacher rights. This was a woman, a young woman, not that young, a woman who was rather openly cohabiting with one of her students, a high school student, and it was a situation which came to the attention of the entire school. I mean, it was much gossiped about and talked about and so on and so forth. After all the procedural things were followed, she was first suspended and then fired. And she took it to court, and she's been reinstated. It's still on appeal and still being litigated. But again, it involves a very serious, it seems to me, abridgment of the authority of the schools in an issue which it really does affect their functioning. I think it's very difficult to keep a high school functioning when you have something that's carried out not only flagrantly but rather defiantly, provocatively, and so on and so forth. So it's very difficult then to exercise what a few years ago we thought of as very customary forms of authority. On the other hand, one can think of back in the old days where teachers couldn't get married and so on and so forth. But as the courts get involved in these rather intramural decisions of a discipline and of curriculum at times, often small details of curriculum, they will decide this has to be taught, no, that can't be taught, and so on and so forth. You see that ebbing away of the...
The most incredible example of all is the Louisiana High School, which refused to play the white basketball players. And then the court got involved, and the federal government got involved, and they switched coaches, and then the new coach refused to play them also, and then they finally decided to play them, and as soon as the white basketball players were got any floor time at all, they began to lose, and then the next thing the school discovered, they'd lost their championship team, and it was an absolute fiasco. I mean, Terry Southern couldn't have done a better job, or Tom Wolfe, in concocting an absolutely crazed set of judicial and regulatory interventions.
When we talk about these instances, all of us, I think, sort of shake our head and say, oh my God, oh my God. If you talk to a lawyer, they think it's terrific. They don't see anything wrong with this, and they are really quite content to do it. They said, well, if you're not doing it well, the judge will have to do it. And it's not that you are merely dealing with the assumption of authority on the part of the justice system, part of the courts and the lawyers and so on and so forth, by default. Sometimes that happens, but I think in these instances there's a sort of positive zest for intervention, and this is what troubles me. And there is very little adversary, so far at least. I'm sure there are lawyers who don't like this, but their vocational bias is, towards the courts knowing better. They're used to, let's say, poorly drafted laws, and the courts do have to go in and sort of make sense of what really happened. But that, or they're used to sort of fiercely disputing, litigants and so on and so forth, and someone has to. And they take that mindset and bring it willy-nilly right into a situation where there is expertise and those law books are simply filled with instances which are, I think, to most of us, horrendous.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 5 in the Center's series on American secondary education. The discussion turns to questions about special problems facing schools with large populations of minority students, the role in education of special interest groups, and the increasing number of court cases which affect students, teachers, and families. That's American Secondary Education, Part 5, this week from the National Humanities Center and Soundings.